And that began a terrifying ride down, which thankfully I don't remember, where I slid, tumbled, and fell almost 1,000 feet to almost the very bottom of Hillman's Highway and was, you know, pretty seriously injured when I did so.
Not going to be all snow. A wintry mix is forecast for the listening area.
Season 2, Engage. My name is Alex Kaufman. This is Wintry Mix. Thanks for holding on with us through the break. We will be releasing new episodes through June, July, and August, which will comprise our summer season. And to kick things off, I should introduce all of you to our new intern. It's Caroline Kessler. Caroline, where do you go to school?
I go to UVM.
What year are you?
I'm going to be a senior this coming fall.
And your major is?
I am majoring in public communication and graphic design.
And where do you shred?
I ski at Stowe a lot, Sugar Bush a lot, Mad River when there's snow. It's not really this winter.
Is that where you grew up skiing?
I grew up at Stowe. My dad was a ski instructor there when I was really young, so I had two older brothers and pretty much started right away.
Well, a wintry mix welcome to you, Caroline, and may I be the first to offer you good luck. And episode 23 is going to kick things off with the story of John Miller, who had one very bad day on Mount Washington last spring, resulting in a helicopter ride to Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. And it's quite the story. Caroline, why don't you get us started with some facts about Mount Washington?
The average annual snowfall for Mount Washington is 282 inches. However, this winter, the mountain received only about 197. On average, 25 people require assistance from one of the area rescue groups while skiing and climbing, and about 150 people have died on Mount Washington to date.
150?
Yeah.
That's a dangerous mountain.
It's a very dangerous mountain.
Thankfully, John Miller is not one of them, and he's here to talk to us today. We'll be right back. Season 2 of Wintry Mix is presented by Intopia. Hold on a second. What is Intopia?
It's a fair question, Alex. Let's ask the team.
Intopia is here to help you sell more and better vacations.
Intopia is not a ski resort.
Intopia is
helping our partners succeed in the ever-changing world of e-commerce.
Really good at Mario Kart.
Intopia is
trusted by ski areas, golf courses, water parks, and more.
Intopia is
focused on customer service.
Let's go ahead and update that price point. And now I'm seeing that product online. Can you confirm you're seeing the same thing on your end?
Intopia is
headquartered in Stowe, Vermont,
where I drink most of my seltzer.
International.
Named Outside Magazine's 100 Best Places to Work.
Intopia is
dog friendly.
Intopia is
working hard but having fun.
Es un grupo de amigos.
Intopia is
always looking for great coders.
Designed to be flexible to adapt to ever-changing e-commerce technologies.
Intopia is
I'm going to stop talking now. Visit us at intopia.com.
So let's continue. Alex Kaufman, episode 23 of Wintry Mix. We are here with John Miller, who is a backcountry skier and has had quite an eventful 2015-16 season. These last few years, you got hooked on backcountry skiing. John, welcome to the studio. What's been the last few years for you in skiing?
Thanks, Alex. Great to be here with you. I'm a fan of the show. It's fun to be a part of it.
Great.
So I'm not a native New Englander or a native Vermonter. I moved here about 5 years ago to start a family. And I knew how to ski. I'm from Maryland, so, you know, I learned how to ski, and I knew of it. Got here and, you know, got hooked up with some friends who were into it. And I don't know if obsession is the right word, but it became my number one pursuit, you know, outside of family life and work life, is backcountry skiing, because there's a lot of reward you get from it. There's a lot you can get out of it. You know, all the things everyone knows about backcountry, no crowds, you're exploring the mountains. I mean, all the benefits I sort of took to heart, and really it became a huge part of my life, I'll be honest.
And this is mostly in the last handful of years since you moved to Vermont, correct?
Yeah, I would say the last 3 years is where it really took off. You know, so two winters ago, that would be the 14-15 winter, right? We know we had a great winter up here. It was fantastic, tons of snow. You know, I think I skied 40 days, almost all of them in the backcountry,
wow.
Skiing, you know, anything and everything, right? And if a season like that doesn't really hook you, then obviously nothing will. So then we came to this season, and it was really just a kind of a commitment of mine to keep exploring. And that's, you know, one of the big parts about being involved in the backcountry scene, I think, is sort of the exploration side of it. You know, whatever you think you can go ski or you want to try or ride, you can. You know, if you want to put in a 5-mile approach it's all on you. That's one of the really fun parts of the sport is sort of getting out there and testing your limits, testing your equipment's limits, and just sort of seeing where you can go with it.
So what was your kind of exploratory learning curve? Where are some of the locations you checked out over the last handful of years as you really got into the sport?
Yeah, so I live in the Burlington area. I live in Charlotte. So, you know, a lot of the local haunts, you know, near Mansfield, Camel's Hump, all those places, even just, you know, starting at the resorts, right? You know, starting with whatever we'd call side country, you know, the back bowls at Smug's and things like that. But I do remember this. There was one day where my buddy took me out to Camel's Hump, and it was, you know, a perfect day. It had just snowed, you know, two-foot storm. And it was like, that was the day that I'll always remember. That was the day that sort of hooked me, that really got me going. As you get better, as you improve as a skier, and as you sort of learn the sport and learn the ethics and all the things that go along with it, you begin to try different things. You go to Mount Washington, right? You go to the Adirondacks. You go up to the Chic-Chocs. You know, you begin to expand into the bigger terrain that we have here on the East Coast.
And you started to expand into that bigger terrain. And we actually have your wife here as well, Alyssa Miller. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Fantastic. And you've got a little extra there with you, don't you, as well?
Yes, Emerson. She's almost 8 weeks old.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. Looks great.
Thank you.
And you've been along for the ride this last handful of years. You moved to Vermont. Your husband, John, got deeply into backcountry skiing with his buddies. What's been your experience of the last few years as he's been earning his turns?
Extra diaper changes and, you know, waking up earlier than I would normally like to on a weekend when he's out at 4 a.m. and I have to get up at, you know, 6. It started when Jenna, my sister, and Ryan, my brother-in-law, like we would sleep over their house and you and Ryan would go out early the next morning up to Smug's because it was closer. And then that evolved to when we had kids having to stay home and then you trying to prep me, you know, a couple days before. So we want to go out, you know, we're thinking about, and I'm like,
warming you up a little bit.
Okay, fine.
You know. Always the best conversations when you gotta lay the groundwork.
Did you have favors that you would return? Would you have to like watch the kids and,
yes,
and let you go out? Like, what was that trade like?
It would be, well, I'll get up early with the kids the next three mornings if I can go out on, you know, Saturday or Sunday, and you know, I'll do bedtime or bath time tonight too, kind of thing.
So there was reasonable give and take from that perspective.
Yes, absolutely.
So as John and his backcountry buddies are traveling further afield, did it really cross your mind at all as far as the safety aspects of backcountry and that, you know, there are things that can go wrong out there?
No, and probably because I'm not a skier, so it didn't really occur to me that those things could happen. You know, he would warn me, we won't have cell service out in the mountain, but I'll be in touch, you know, when we get back to the car kind of thing. He would always leave the house. I'll be safe. I'm like, okay, you know, I was never that worried. I think there'd be a couple times you came home and it was like, yeah, it was a little rough out there. But again, maybe because I'm not a skier, it just never occurred to me to even like be worried.
So unfortunately, that day did come that all skiers generally dread where something does go wrong. John, do you remember much about, you know, that morning, the mundane details, what you had for breakfast, that sort of thing? Tell me about how that day started.
I do. I remember everything up until the actual accident that occurred. So it was a Sunday in March, and my good friend Art and I decided to do a day trip over to Mount Washington. So we left early. I think we got on the road at like 4 a.m. or something like that. So we got over to Mount Washington. It was honestly a nice spring day. It was, you know, bluebird. We hiked into the Gulf of Slides and had a couple hours of just fantastic skiing. Obviously, we know it was a low snow year. There was a lot less snow on the mountain than in previous years, but we were skiing really great corn for a couple hours. And we ended that and decided to finish the day. We would hike up and over the ridge to the area of Tuckerman Ravine, and we were going to ski a line called Hillman's Highway, which is a pretty famous sort of backcountry line in that area. By the time we did it, the sun had gone far enough down where the run fell back into shadow. As anybody who's listening to this who knows backcountry skiing knows, right, when you're talking spring corn, you want to be in the sun, right? Everything's soft and it's great. When the freeze line happens, when things fall back into shadow, especially at altitude like on Mount Washington, very quickly, it turns from being the ideal snow you want to being ice and refrozen, and that's what happened to us.
So the event itself, if you can, you know, what you remember, you're at the top of Hillman's Highway, mm-hmm. The people down at the hut are looking up Hillman's Highway, you know, the decision process as you're deciding what you're going to do next.
It was a really interesting period. And my wife earlier mentioned, you know, she's not a skier, so she just, it never crossed her mind. I was a skier. I was an avid backcountry enthusiast, or I am an avid backcountry enthusiast. I understand safety. I take it very seriously. But none of us realized just how dangerous it was until something terrible happened. It just doesn't cross your mind, right? You don't stand at the top of a ski run and think, well, I could fall here. And if I do fall, something really bad's going to happen. It's just not really part of your process, right? As you're strapping in your bindings and getting ready, you're thinking, okay, this is going to be a challenge. We knew it was refrozen. We knew it was going to be sketchy, but we'd skied the line before, right? We'd done it before. We had experience. You're thinking, okay, let's take it easy. Let's be really cautious. This is not the time for hero turns or, you know, jumping stuff. Let's just get down safely. That's what's going through your mind. It's not what happens if I fall. It's almost like we're just not wired to think that way. So I've probably set it up pretty well by giving you that intro. We skied about a third of the way down and we got to a choke point where it just brought you to a particular little spot. There was rocks on one side, branches on the other. It just was a natural choke point in the snow. Unfortunately, it was right above an ice bulge. And what happened to me is I fell just trying to negotiate my way through the choke point. It wasn't like I fell jumping off something or, you know, making this big GS turn. I literally slipped trying to get my skis through this really small point. And unfortunately, when I fell right onto basically water ice.
Yeah.
And that began a terrifying ride down, which thankfully I don't remember, yeah, where I slid, tumbled, and fell almost 1,000 feet to almost the very bottom of Hillman's Highway and was, you know, pretty seriously injured when I did so.
Wow, man. Those details and more when we come back. Excuse me while I buy a cord of wood real quick. Additional support for Wintry Mix comes from Snowbird, Utah, located 30 minutes from Salt Lake City International Airport and receiving an average of 500 inches per season. Check out snowbird.com to whet your powder appetite. Peak Resorts also lends a hand. Visit and or Google Mount Snow, Attitash, Wildcat, Crotchet, Hunter Mountain, or Jack Frost this summer. The event calendars are packed. And thanks to Ski Vermont for being down with the mix as well. Visit skivermont.com. Then you'll want to come visit. Okay, John, let's continue. Sounds like you're really at the top of a no-fall zone right at that moment.
Yeah, we were. And it was a combination of several factors, you know, being later in the day. So what snow there was, even in a low snow year, was sketchy and refrozen and was no picnic to get down. You had ice bulges. You had rocks exposed. You know, I had skied Hillman's a year prior, and I remember thinking at that time when I skied it, this is like a run to a ski resort. It was 50 yards wide, right? Because it was all filled in with snow. When we were there in March, you know, we were trying to thread the needle through a gap not even as wide as your skis. You know, I went to step. My bottom edge slipped out from me. I just fell on my butt. I fell over onto my side. And going back and watching the footage later, it's amazing how fast I picked up speed. As you mentioned, it was a no-fall zone. I fell down, and within 5 seconds, I was probably 100 feet down the mountain. You know, went over an ice ball, started tumbling. My skis came off. You know, my friends who were with me mentioned that, you know, I was out of sight within, you know, it almost happened faster than they could react. You know, I was having a conversation with my friend Art. This is really sketchy. I'm going to put my ski here. You know, I'm going to try to come over to you. I fell over and that was it. You know, it was like I was shot out of a cannon.
And you said footage. So there was footage.
There was.
You had a GoPro on? Your friend had a GoPro on?
Yeah, we both had GoPros on our helmets. So my GoPro stayed on for about 10 seconds, and then it came off.
Oh, wow.
You know, I call it my nightmare footage, right? Going back and rewatching that because it's point of view, right? It's everything as it's happening in a second. It didn't stay on very long because I was doing some tumbling, and it came off. And amazingly, somebody mailed it back to me. You know, the Eastern ski community is an amazing group of people, the people that helped out with my rescue, the people that sent me support. And literally when I got home, there was a package sitting in my house. Someone found my GoPro.
And then found out it was you. How did they know it was yours?
Alyssa, you know the story.
It was either Art or my cousin Casey. We're on the Facebook backcountry community forum or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
And I think someone posted about it and knew Art. And so Art had given them our address and it came to our house.
Yeah. So there was that footage. And then, as I mentioned, my friend Art had a GoPro on, which is just him standing there watching me fall. It's all hard to watch. But
how long did it take you before you were able to watch it? When did you watch it?
So I watched my footage pretty early on after coming home from the hospital and was freaked out by it.
Yeah.
Like it took me like a half an hour to calm down. You know, I had like a visceral reaction to it. Like
yeah.
I was sweating.
I was really angry, actually, that he had watched it that fast. You know, all the doctors had kind of said, you know, take it easy. Let's not try to remember too much about the accident if you can. They had kept telling us to control the conversation about the accident. And so within 48 hours of you being home, you were on the computer, which is, again, something you weren't really supposed to be doing, watching the footage.
Well, Alyssa, let's shift it back over to you then. So when this occurs, where are you? How did you find out?
I was home making dinner for the boys at the time. Again, I was 35 weeks pregnant, I think, home with our 3.5-year-old and our 1.5-year-old. And it was about 6 o'clock, 6:30 when I was starting to get a little annoyed with him because I was expecting to have already received a text message or a phone call saying we're on our way back. I'd kept telling him, be home by 7, help out with bath and bedtime tonight. That's all I ask. Like, do whatever you want, but just be home by 7. And then I had sent my sister a message saying, I feel really bad about this message now. If he's not home by 7:30, he better not even come home tonight.
Oh, my gosh. So
I was angry. Yeah.
That's in print somewhere.
Yeah, I was a little annoyed. So just after I had sent that message to my sister, she probably arrived to my house 25 minutes later. It was like, I think, 6:30. The doorbell rang, and it was like, you know, who's coming to my house on a Sunday night at 6:30?
Doorbell.
Odd. Yeah. I actually thought maybe it could have been John who was locked out, but again, I hadn't heard from him. So I go to the door, and I don't know if you've ever, if someone's ever told you in person that someone has died, but there's a look on someone's face. And so when I got to the door, I could see my cousin Casey and my sister. And if you know Casey, he has a lot of emotion, and his face was completely just frozen. There was no smile, no nothing. And so I just opened the door, pretty panicked. And the first thing my sister said to me is, he's okay, but we gotta go.
Yep. And the person you hear nursing is the person you were pregnant with when you got that information.
Correct.
Oh my gosh. John, the people that came to your aid, do you remember? Are you told stories about what happened after you fell? What kind of shape were you in at that time?
Yeah, so all of it I have to piece together because my memory goes blank basically at the fall. I have one final memory of just pure panic, mm-hmm. of like I'm falling down a mountain and I can't stop and this is really bad. And then my memory is blank for about 2 weeks. I don't really remember anything until about 2 weeks later in the hospital. So what I have is the accounts my friends told me and other people that I've talked to. You know, we were wondering the other day, like, I wonder how long my fall actually took. It couldn't have taken that long,
right,
to go that far in that kind of condition. But it still took them almost 10 minutes to get to me because they were being safe. And clearly they had now an example of, you know, what happened if they fell. So there was just, you know, total survival skiing. They got to me about 10 minutes later. And then about a half hour after that, the guys at the avalanche center at Hermit Lake, those guys came up. So a whole crew came out and, you know, they dug a ledge and put me in a litter and they had to lower me down using ropes because it was so icy. And, you know, someone made a call to Dartmouth Hitchcock and they brought out the DART, which is their sort of like trauma flight emergency helicopter. And some pilot who I still don't know his name, I'd like to thank him, landed the DART helicopter. For those of you that ski in the East, they literally landed it next to the deck at Hojo's. And if you've been there and you know this, like, you're probably like me, that's not a spot I think you could land a helicopter.
Yeah.
It was a low wind day. They somehow managed to land it there. And I think within 2 hours of my accident, I was on the way to the hospital.
So a bit of a fast forward. What are we, a month and a half later or 2 months later right now?
Yes.
You were in the hospital at Dartmouth Hitchcock for how long? You've been home for how long? Give me the time scale of your recovery.
Sure. I spent almost a month in the hospital, and that was split between about 2.5 weeks at Dartmouth Hitchcock, where I was flown, and then I was transferred back up to Burlington to Fannie Allen, which is part of the UVM center. And I came home almost a month afterwards. And as I mentioned, I was really seriously injured. I had a brain injury, a traumatic brain injury, to use the technical medical term. I broke my shoulder. I had a punctured lung. I had broken ribs.
He actually didn't know the extent of his injuries until we were meeting with the ortho surgeon up at UVM, and Dr. Endres asked John, you know, what other injuries besides his shoulder? He's like, oh, just a couple bumps and bruises. And I was looking at him like, are you kidding me? You broke your ribs, you had a punctured lung, temple fracture, nose fracture, road rash. Yeah.
Why didn't you know? You hadn't been told, or you had been blocking it out?
My memory just you know, there's about a 2-week gap, and I think most of that I'd recovered from, at least in the interim, by the time I sort of came back around. And, you know, my recovery was a really interesting period, because there was times in the beginning where they didn't know what was going to happen because I had a brain injury. You know, I wasn't talking right at first, and, you know, I couldn't really walk. So it was a very serious thing. And thankfully, luckily, you know, I'm so thankful to be, you know, be here today talking to you and back with my family and about to go back to work. And, you know, I basically walked away from this, I won't say unscathed, but I was extremely lucky in the way that I recovered.
You look pretty good right here, right now.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
I know, you. Alyssa, you look amazing. I don't know how you got through this. How did you get through this as far as family support? You have your third child in here with you. What have the last couple months been like for you as far as just managing a household and handling John's recovery?
Chaos. You know, the managing the household and just a lot of family and friend support. We definitely would have never made it through without all of our friends up here and our family who are here, but also who are in Maryland, Pittsburgh, down in Connecticut where my parents live. It's the only way we would have made it through. My sister was a huge part. She's a nurse at UVM, so she was with me almost every day while he was at Dartmouth, trying to figure out what the diagnosis and prognosis would be. And then beyond that, she was also, her and my brother-in-law would watch the boys, and they have three kids of their own. My cousin Casey and my cousin Brian and their families would also chip in and watch the boys where they could. Again, everyone has their own families as well, three kids, two kids. And then our friends set up a GoFundMe page, and that, just the amount of support we received from that financially and just all the nice notes people left us. It was reading those things and having people reach out to you who you haven't talked to in 20 years, you realize how lucky we were and we are.
And I'm going to go kind of on a side street of that. So I gave you guys $50.
Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Thank you.
And a lot of times this happens. When people are in need, they get this great amount of giving. And we were chatting about this before, John. So you don't know what your medical bills are going to be yet, obviously. They're going to probably keep coming in. They might come in for years. What'd you guys do? 50 grand, 60 grand, right?
It's, yeah, almost 60. That number still, I have a hard time saying it out loud. So, it's crazy.
So you guys might surpass that. You might have 100 grand in medical bills. And if so, obviously you got 60 grand to help you out. Great. But what if you only have 40? What are you going to do with the 20 grand? What happens to that money? Come on.
You pay it forward.
Yeah, I think pay it forward is the way to go. And we've been talking about this. You know, there are absolutely some organizations that we want to donate to. I mean, everything from people that helped me, you know, the Mount Washington Avalanche team, the Mount Washington Ski Patrol, the DART Fund. You know, there's all kinds of brain injury, charities you can donate to. But I think paying it forward is the way to go, because that's what happened to us. You know, there's two main takeaways that I have from this experience. The first is the normal one, like, you know, how did I get myself into that situation? How did I expose myself to that much risk as a person that had this much to lose? So all the safety things. But the second one is, and Alyssa said it was unbelievable how generous people were, and they wanted to help. And she's right, people we haven't spoken to in decades.
So let's move to more of a 40,000 foot level on this topic. Everyone ages in our sport differently. I'm 36. We're kind of the same age, right?
We are, yep.
Yeah. And, you know, we have the growing families, the mortgage payments, those sorts of things. And in my case, I have a bad back. I have bad knees. They've kind of slowed me down slowly. Other people get there with more abrupt events. You know, how does it affect you? What is your outlook now? Has it changed? Is it different? How much skiing are you doing next year? I mean, where's your mind around all that?
Yeah, absolutely. It could never be the same to go through an event like I went through, where it was life-threatening and it was life-altering. You know, there's almost no way I could approach it the same way again. It has to change. And that's the point where I am in my life. You know, I've learned over time that risk is a very personal thing. You know, the amount of risk you are willing to take on, what you're willing to do to get enjoyment out of something and push the envelope is really a personal thing. And so for me, you know, there's so much to lose. There's so much else at stake. I love skiing, and I know that I'll ski again. I knew that very early on after I had sort of mentally recovered and, like, you know, knew where I was again, knew what day it was and what my name was. I knew early on I don't want to just walk away from the sport completely. You know, I do want to ski again. But how I will ski and the decisions I will make will be different. The benefit, the nice thing is you can think about it and go back and look at what you did, and you can realize that a lot of it is in your control. You know, I'll give you a little example. As we were preparing to drop in on Hillman's, both Art and I later, you know, after I'd recovered, we had a deep discussion about it. We both admitted to each other that we had doubts. you know, as we were putting our skis on, both of us were like, you know, this is a little sketchy and I don't know about this. Is this really worth it? And we both had the same thoughts and we didn't express them,
yeah.
Right? It's very typical of what you read about in group situations and this and that. You know, you just go with the flow and nobody wants to be the person that, you know, cries uncle or whatever, but it happened to us. And so knowing all of this and processing all of this will sort of set a course for how I'll approach skiing the rest of my life. Because I still want to ski, I still want to do it, and I know that I can have a lot of fun and go the rest of my career without ever putting myself in that kind of situation again. Because, you know, my wife and my six-week-old daughter are sitting right here. It's just not worth it, right? The best turns in the world are not worth jeopardizing and losing all of that.
All you got to do is start skiing with me, dude. I don't get after it. It's so pathetic.
I remember your cul-de-sac backcountry rant one of the earlier episodes, and I was like, maybe that's the way to go now. You're right.
I fit it in little two-hour chunks like before and skiing, after my office hours within about 10 to 15 miles of my house. That's kind of my MO. It's not because I don't want to go to Tuckerman. I do want to go to Tuckerman, but it's basically just because my knees and back end up being hurt even when I don't fall, and I've just had enough years of that being beat into me that I've just kind of relegated myself to small, local, only powder skiing.
Good. Well, let's get together next year and make
sure.
So
this year we're
doing
that. Okay. And Alyssa, I think you're in favor of that, right?
I am definitely in favor of that.
Cul-de-sac backcountry.
But Caroline, your job, how old are you, Caroline, right now?
I'm 21.
Your job is to charge it for us.
Your job is to go crush it.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Cool with that.
Okay. John and I are going to take it easy. Caroline's going to crush it. And we'll be right back. Thanks, guys. Wintry Mix is a partnership with Vermont Public Radio and has support from VPR and their members. I'm Alex Kaufman, your host and producer, and VPR staff who help with the program include Liam Connors and Angela Evansy. Our theme music is by Adam Levy, and you can hear more of his music on our website, wintrymixcast.com. Follow us on social media for industry shenanigans and to have your chance to win L.L. Bean gear giveaways for listeners. They are coming up later in the season. iTunes reviews are always appreciated. They help others find the show, and it's, you know, pretty much the least you can do. Stay tuned and stay safe. Caroline, why don't you get us started with some facts about Mount Washington?
All right. Well, the average annual snowfall for Mount Washington.
Stop. Yeah. We haven't introduced her yet. This is the first episode.
Oh, yeah.